Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What is the right amount of media exposure for children in this ever more connected world? Many parents' concerns about the potential hazards of too much TV, video gaming, internet surfing, and social media seem to be evenly matched by their sons' and daughters' interest in spending time interacting. My guest today understands those pressures as president and CEO of the nonpartisan watchdog group Common Sense Media and as a parent of four children himself. James P. Steyer shares his expert perspective in his new book, Talking Back to Facebook, The Common Sense Guide to Raising Kids in the Digital Age. Jim, welcome to Think.
Great to be here.
You write that we live in a culture of eye distraction. Talk about that and talk about why it might be an even bigger problem for children with developing brains than it is for their parents.
Well, the term eye distraction basically refers to the fact that it's pretty hard today to get kids and adults to pay attention when there are so many impulsive type pings, if you will, from your cell phone, your BlackBerry, your Facebook, or other digital devices. And so oftentimes we see that in terms of people driving while texting or texting while driving. We see that in people having conversations and constantly looking down at their cell phone or their BlackBerry, and just so many different ways today in which technology can interfere on a more concentrated way of dealing with other people. Now, young brains are not fully formed. And in doing research for Talking Back to Facebook, I had to speak with some of the leading pediatric neurologists in the United States and some of the other leading brain development experts. And what became clear to a layperson like myself, who is a parent, as you mentioned, is that young brains are particularly susceptible to some of these impulse-driven stimuli from digital media. And so kids are oftentimes distracted in ways that can detract from their social, emotional, and cognitive development.
Yeah, you identify three primary concerns: relationship issues, addiction and attention problems, and lack of privacy.
Well, I think they're all big ones.
Yeah.
As a parent, and as everybody out there who are parents or educators in the audience would know, those are pretty big ones.
Mm-hmm.
Relationships, to me, and the way that human beings today communicate, and the impact of digital media on connection and intimacy and self-image are really important things for us to consider, because there can be real benefits, but there can also be some real downsides.
You know, the Facebook thing is really interesting because there's recent research that says, well, adults largely find it a reasonably positive experience and they're not getting mean messages from their online friends. It is not the same for young people, and so parents might not quite recognize how dangerous it can be.
Well, I think that's a great point. I mean, for most of us adults, we did not grow up with these digital devices. And indeed, we never heard of a cell phone, let alone an iPhone or an iPad or Twitter when we were growing up. And so I think that many times the values and judgments that we have as adults have enabled us to put exciting new platforms like Facebook or Twitter in their proper context and not make them a substitute for face-to-face human relationships, etc. Young people, being digital natives, oftentimes have a different experience. I certainly know that's true for my own four children. And so there's a degree of homework that I think all parents need to do around this topic, educators as well, because we do use these platforms differently. The one thing I would add, though, is that increasingly as we have this conversation, and the point of writing a book, Talking Back to Facebook, was to create that conversation or help catalyze it, is that young people are increasingly learning the do's and don'ts and the rules of the road. And that's a very positive sign, because platforms, if used wisely, can also have a lot of beneficial aspects to them.
That was one thing that I found really useful. I also have four children. As a parent, you're not saying, you know, turn off, you know, unplug everything and keep your kids in a quiet room with a book for the next 10 years. You're saying teach them ways to use these things responsibly and teach them limits.
That's right. And to have some common sense rules and some common sense guides to raising kids in this extraordinary new digital age. That said, you mentioned the word unplug. I actually think unplugging is a very important part of child rearing and for both adults and young people today. It's easy in a world where I believe these devices are actually quite addictive, or certainly compulsive for many of us, that you, it's very important in that context that we actually unplug and take timeouts from digital media and all media and devices in general, that we have very clear media-free zones or device-free zones, like meals, for example. I mean, you've got four kids. I've got four kids. We certainly never permit any phone or device at a meal time in the Steyer household.
Sure.
And I think that's a very simple rule for all parents to understand and for young people to learn, because they'll be parents one day as well, which is we don't want the family conversation and the catch-up that happens at a breakfast, lunch, or dinner to be interrupted by the constant pinging of a cell phone or a CrackBerry or a Facebook notification. And I think it's a very important and simple lesson that all families can try to adopt.
One concern you have about Facebook is that it puts a lot of pressure on children who are still experimenting with who they are, figuring out their identities, and now they've got this burden of sharing that with the rest of the world in what amounts to a sort of permanent record of their social development.
That's right. Again, that's a great question. And I think that what you see is that a term that my colleague at MIT, Sherry Turkle, first used about a year ago, presentation anxiety, occurs today for particularly for teens and even occasionally preteens who are on Facebook and other social network platforms, because they're constantly reshuffling, in some cases, photoshopping their images, mm-hmm. constantly trying to present a digital image to the world. And as you mentioned, there's no eraser button right now.
Yeah.
It's permanent. You have to live with the consequences of what you present. But what I see in my own children, and certainly in the many teens who I interviewed for this book and who I see as a professor at Stanford, is that particularly teen girls live on these platforms and spend so much time worrying about how they're going to present their image to their friends. In the case of Facebook, that might mean 2,000 friends, and to the broader public. And quite frankly, the technology companies are encouraging this. In one of the mantras of Facebook is frictionless sharing,
yeah.
meaning put out everything for the world. But that actually, in a vulnerable 12, 13, 14-year-old teenager, might lead to a whole lot of anxiety and social-emotional consequences where, again, there's no way to erase what you've done.
And I was interested in the research that said that, in fact, it's been proven that girls are more likely to, I forget the term, but essentially share something without reflecting on it
right.
first.
Well, the term I use in the book a lot, and I think that it's really helpful for our listening audience to think about, is self-reveal before you self-reflect.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And another way to talk about it that's pretty simple for people is think before hitting the send button.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that one of the big issues of privacy today, in the book I break down privacy into two big issues. The first is that kids self-reveal before they self-reflect. And that can have real consequences. I think some of the more extreme examples of cyberbullying and sexting and kids just putting stuff out there that they really later come to regret, nearly half of all teens say that they've already done that, is a reflection of the impulsive nature of these platforms. That's going back to your earlier question about impulse and brain development, but also that there were no rules of the road. These are new technology platforms that lend themselves to sort of impulsive, quick decisions that teenagers and kids in particular tend to regret. We see that in adults. I certainly see that in adults as well, but I think it's particularly true for young people. And we need to teach them to self-reflect before they self-reveal.
We should say, and you take pains to note in the book, that technically Facebook says no accounts to anybody under 13, but there is ample evidence that this is broken every single day.
That's right. And again, I don't want to, the point of the book, even though Facebook is in the title and it is called Talking Back to Facebook, it's not the only player in this. And I know the people who run that company quite well. We've worked with them as well as with most of the technology giants for years in trying to urge them to be more thoughtful about and accountable to their teen audience. But you're correct. What we know about the data from Consumer Reports is that last year, the Consumer Reports data was about estimated 7.5 million kids in the United States under 13 on Facebook. And the reason the 13 age matters is because the only privacy law that exists around children and privacy is a law called COPPA, written in 1998, the Stone Ages of the Internet, if you will, but which restricts certain kind of advertising and certain kinds of data collection among people under the age of 13. So Facebook and many of the other platforms that primarily aim at teens and adults claim not to have anybody under 13, but the data makes it clear that there are many millions of kids under 13 who are on Facebook. And if you talk to any other parent out there, you know that kids, or a teacher, you know that kids as young as 9, 10, and 11 are begging or trying to go on Facebook and just creating fake identities or fake ages and going on. So this is not a problem confined to teenagers at all.
And there is that pressure for a lot of teenagers to get on these media platforms if their friends are on.
Right.
And one of the things you say, if you make the decision to allow your child to have a Facebook account or something similar, is to insist that they friend you.
Well, I think that's a good thing. And, you know, having four children of my own, three of whom are teenagers, who do, I will add, consider me to be the world's most embarrassing dad.
and good for you.
As Common Sense Media has become such a large and popular organization over the past 8 or 9 years, it's really, they always say, it's our worst nightmare that, unfortunately, you work at Common Sense. But the truth is, I do think if you friend your children, it doesn't mean you have to spy on them and constantly monitor their activities. But it does make it clear to them that you want to see how they're presenting themselves. And then, in a sense, you as a parent want to be there as a guide and to sometimes help them with judgment. Going back to the brain development issue, the last part of the brain that develops in our society is the executive function, mm-hmm. which is the function that as the word executive would imply, is about judgment and reason and thoughtful decision-making. And all of us know that we as teens made a lot of impulsive decisions, and certainly preteens do as well. So there is a value in, as a parent, whether being a friend on Facebook, because then you have access to your kid's page if you choose to exercise it. It's the same as saying, I don't want you to put a TV set or a computer in your bedroom. We want it to be in a common room, because then I, as a parent, have the right to come in and look at that from time to time and see what you're doing or what you're surfing. I think that's a very important message to send to kids in terms of the dialogue between parents and children on these issues. And in the case of Facebook, just friending your children, even if you don't want to monitor what they do every day, is a good way to make it clear that you consider it important that they be thoughtful and that they, as I said earlier, self-reflect before they self-reveal or post on Facebook.
Talk about this, Jim, because I, too, am a very uncool parent. But I have other friends who say, well, I don't feel like I have the right to ask my children for passwords or to go into their phones and read their messages because they deserve privacy.
Well, I think it's a great question. And again, you and I are talking about exactly the issues that all parents face in this if you're going to be an engaged and involved parent, which of course we hope everyone out there will be. I mean, but I think it's a good question, because we do want our kids to have their privacy. I think during teen years, it's particularly true. As I said, having three teenagers of my own, including one 17-year-old monosyllabic boy who occasionally grunts an answer or two to his pops or his mom, you know, they do need their privacy, and they need their space to grow up and to develop their identities, et cetera. They really do need that, and you want, as a parent, to give them that. Mm-hmm. That said, however, you need to teach them about privacy. You know, until recently, we heard some of the giants of the tech industry, like Mark Zuckerberg or Eric Schmidt, the executive chairman of Google, say certain things like Mark said, oh, privacy norms have all changed in the past few years. Social norms have changed. And Eric Schmidt said, well, privacy, you know, if you say put something up, maybe you shouldn't have done it in the first place, and you can always change your identity in the future. So the industry has taken a somewhat cavalier approach to our kids' privacy. And while I believe that kids do need that zone of experimentation and privacy as they're growing up, say as teens or even late preteens, you do need to teach them about those rules, but you also need to be able to say, I'm sorry, there's certain things here as a parent that I need to be informed about, because you can make some mistakes in judgment. And that's the constant balancing dialogue that goes on between parents and their children. And no two families are the same.
Let me jump in here. We got to take a quick break. My guest is James P. Steyer, founder and CEO of Common Sense Media and author of Talking Back to Facebook, The Common Sense Guide to Raising Kids in the Digital Age. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
Yeah. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is James P. Steyer. He's founder and CEO of Common Sense Media, which is a nonpartisan group dedicated to improving the media lives of children and families. His new book is called Talking Back to Facebook, The Common Sense Guide to Raising Kids in the Digital Age. Join this conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Jim, before the break, you were making the point that no two families are alike, no two kids are alike, and certainly no two ages are alike. And it looks like reading this book that we may have to revisit the rules we set for media use and consumption a lot more frequently than many parents might be doing now.
I think that's exactly right, Chris. And boy, you can tell that you're a mom. That's all I can say. I think we do, no question, because the world has changed. It's amazing. You know, Common Sense Media is only 9 years old, and when we first started out, we rated all the movies, TV, video games, music, books, et cetera, out there. And boy, when the digital media platforms exploded, first it was MySpace, actually, and then YouTube, Facebook, cell phones, Twitter, you name it. The world has changed, so you have to rewrite the rules. For example, one of the rules I wrote in a book 10 years ago, The Other Parent, which was the book that in many ways launched Common Sense Media, was about no TV in a bedroom or no video game machine or major entertainment platform in your kid's bedroom. Well, when your kid has a cell phone, including a smartphone, as many kids do today, that's a much tougher rule to enforce, and you have to update it. And the devices are changing, the technology is changing at warp speed, and we as parents have to keep up as best as we can. I mean, literally, that's why we have Common Sense Media, and it's why I wrote this book.
Yeah, we discovered a few months ago that my son has an iPod Touch, and it's just like a television in the room, which I would never allow, and so finally we had to change the rules for that device.
But that's exactly right. You know, we obviously at Common Sense, we do a lot about kids' TV usage, which still, by the way, remains the number one form of media and entertainment that kids consume. It's still TV if you look at the hours per day. But as you know, as a parent, and as many of our listeners know, a lot of that TV viewing by kids today is done on their computer or their iPod Touch or their phone.
YouTube.
And so The venue has changed, the platform has changed, and therefore the rules have to adjust accordingly. And it is a constant challenge to parenting in the digital age, but there are simple rules and tips that all of us can follow that make it manageable and ultimately give us the ability to give our kids the guidance and common sense that they need to be smart consumers.
One way that you do reassure parents is, you know, everybody has this fear. It's not an urban legend necessarily, but it hasn't really been borne out by the facts. This fear that there are stalkers online looking for places where there are young children or middle school children and trying to prey upon them sexually, that doesn't turn out to be a very common occurrence.
You're exactly right, Chris. It is not. But and that said, it's when we first saw the development of the internet and when people started getting on it by the millions and billions, there was a huge fear-based approach in many ways to online safety. And I mean fear-based because I think that was the way it was portrayed to a lot of the average parents out there and even educators, that if your kid went online or used, this was, by the way, pre-iPhones, iPads, iPod Touches, et cetera, that they could be stalked and, you know, they would be lured to a mall by a predator who would rape them or kill them or something just horrible. Indeed, the statistics bear out that this is an extremely infrequent occurrence and that, in fact, kids are as smart as we know and do not are rarely tempted by that. That's not to say that there aren't predators who go into internet chat rooms and that there aren't significant issues of weird pedophiles and online predators, et cetera. That exists, but it's a tiny, tiny, tiny fraction of the reality, and it's not something that a large percentage of kids will ever encounter in any way. So parents have to make their kids aware to avoid that, but kids are pretty smart, and the data makes it clear that it's a tiny percentage. The much bigger issues are how both pro and con this new digital media and the extraordinary revolution it's led to in human relationships impacts the social, emotional, and cognitive development of children and teens. And that affects everybody. That's not the tiny percentage. That's everybody, so we need common sense ways to deal with it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak on the phone to Alice in Dallas. Hi, Alice.
Hi, how are you guys?
Great, thank you.
I was just listening, and as an adult, it's even hard to keep your privacy. You know, at work, people are always asking questions that are personal, and you don't want to come across to be mean or, you know, by saying, well, that's none of your business. But it's even hard for adults to figure out the right way to say, it's none of your business. You know, they'll just ask questions out of the blue because they hear that you're leaving or you're going somewhere or something's happening in your life because you may have a friend in the office that, you know, privacy it's not respected. So that's my comment.
Yeah, thanks for your call. That is an interesting point, Jim, that adults seem to want to know information. And a lot of these social media, with regard to children, it's almost like you have to opt out of giving information rather than doing the default.
Well, that's exactly right, Chris. And to me, that's one of the things that we at Common Sense on a national basis have really tried to push, that the idea that opt-out is an industry-created standard and that the standard ought to actually be opt-in and one of informed consent. And I think our caller made that point very well. I mean, the truth is we have, if you look at the broader economic context in which this is happening, our headquarters at Common Sense are here in the Bay Area. We have offices around the country and work in schools in Dallas and all across Texas. But our headquarters are here right in the heart of technology land. And the industry wants an opt-out standard because then they can collect and aggregate anybody's data, basically. And because if you have an 80-page privacy policy that you have to read at the end on a cell phone, no one ever reads it in the first place. And basically they can collect and aggregate whatever they want in terms of your personal information and data. We believe strongly that opt-in should be the universal standard, certainly for kids and teenagers. And that then gives the power to the consumer and to the child and the parent, as it should be when it comes to privacy. But this is a big discussion that's going to have to happen over the next few years, and where we may indeed need political leadership as well, because opt-in and informed consent give the power to the user. And when we're talking about our personal private information, to me, it seems rather clear that opt-in is the logical standard. But winning that battle when a technology industry is focusing on data as the holy grail can be a challenge.
You know, reading last week about Mark Zuckerberg's wedding, I wondered if when he has a 13-year-old daughter, his ideas about everybody wanting to share things will change.
I think that's, Chris, I say that all the time to Mark Zuckerberg and his peers in the Valley. And I mean that very much. I think that if you even look at some of the companies whom we work with at Common Sense and the CEOs of whom I tend to know and have known for a number of years in some cases, those who are parents and have kids in the 8 to 15 or 18 age range really understand these issues. And quite frankly, it impacts their company's policies. One of the challenges we faced with this extraordinary new digital revolution, and by the way, for which there are many, many benefits, and which I applaud the Mark Zuckerbergs of the world for doing because they're an engine of great economic and positive social impact as well. One of the things, the problem is you have 20-something engineers who have no clue about raising kids, who've never even thought about the impact of some of their data aggregation strategies on broader society, and particularly on young people. And so we need them to have children, but in the meantime, we need to hold these companies accountable for their actions and what their products do. And that is a balance that needs to be struck. And I believe it's starting to happen. And I believe that's why I wrote Talking Back to Facebook, partly, was to say we need a national conversation, if not a global conversation, and we need a wake-up call to consumers and the broader public to say, this is our personal information, these are our children, we want to change some of these rules.
Okay, I don't want to get too far into this conversation without bringing up the subject of video games. And if we're generalizing to say that some social media may present more dangers to girls, I think it's reasonable to say that sort of addiction to video games may be a greater danger to boys. How much do we need to worry about games that aren't necessarily violent and graphic, but certainly suck up a lot of time and attention?
Boy, great question, Chris. And as the father of two boys, I would tell you, you definitely have to be concerned about that and aware of that. You know, I have a 17-year-old who is in himself, he would just complain again about his embarrassing father, but who, if we let him, he'd sit in front of his Xbox and play FIFA soccer for 3 or 4 hours a day because he loves it. And by the way, since Common Sense are the people who led the whole video game fight over the past 5 years, to prevent the sale of ultra-violent and sexually violent video games like Grand Theft Auto to 12-year-olds, we certainly know that side of the issue. But the addiction issue is a bigger one because they are addicting, and the data is there about that. In fact, in Asian countries, Korea and Singapore, which I wrote about in my book, they actually have camps that are rehab camps for kids who are addicted to video games and other digital devices. And you're correct, Chris. Boys, and particularly teen boys, are most at risk for this kind of compulsive or addictive behavior. And if you look at the body of research, it clearly is compulsive and addictive behavior, and parents need to be aware of that and set clear limits.
And the thing that comes up in the book is that sometimes these games, not always, sometimes they are used as a sort of escape from the real world, and we all need an escape, but an escape for kids who may be struggling socially, but ultimately in escaping, they also sort of deny themselves a chance to practice with real human beings.
That's exactly right. And the truth is, by the way, we all do need escape, so you're correct, and there are some fabulous games out there. And if people who use Common Sense Media or go to commonsense.org know, we rate all the games, and there are many good ones, and we also believe that games can be an important part of the next generation of educational content and products. So at Common Sense, we're big fans of games, and I am, if used wisely. But that said, there is no question that you have to both be aware of the content of certain games and also the addicting nature of that digital medium, because there's a brain issue there and a brain stimulus issue that's very real, and which just a lot of adults, I would say, think of your own use of your BlackBerry / CrackBerry or cell phone and how you constantly are drawn to that. Well, the gaming video game digital world is similar in the sense that games like Worlds of Warcraft, for example, or some of the more violent games like Call of Duty have definite addicting qualities, and kids, particularly boys, will sit in front of those screens for hours and hours and hours on end unless limits are placed. It's a big issue to deal with, and video games are a part of the digital future, no question. They're a much bigger industry, for example, than the movie industry is today.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the phone, we have Brian in Plano. Hey, Brian.
Hi, how are you today?
Very well, thanks.
Good. The discussion has been focused on digital media, which has been wonderful so far. The challenge I have as a parent is text and books and e-books. Has there been any discussion about limiting that media consumption as well and where it's going?
Jim?
That's a great question, Brian. I mean, you know, it's interesting because e-books are one of the big, as all publishers know, it's one of the major new trends in the broader publishing industry. And I'm a huge fan of reading, and one of the lessons that at Common Sense we all encourage everyone is, you know, read more to your children, expose them to books. I know that all the educators, educational colleagues I have also want to encourage that. And so clearly a lot of kids now read their books and other forms of text like newspapers and magazines on a screen. The big issue there is the amount of screen time. There is just beginning to be research on this topic about the difference between experiencing a book on an e-book format like an iPad or a Kindle or a Nook versus, say, reading a physical book. And I think it depends on the individual preferences. The only health downside can be the screen time as opposed to sitting in a chair or in some of the incredibly beautiful parts of Texas and the Southwest where you can be out in nature and reading a book. So that's the one issue that I tend to think of in the context of Brian's question is the amount of screen time if you're using a Nook or a Kindle as opposed to reading a paperback or a hardback book.
So the idea, in other words, if you're sitting in a place, some of these devices can be used outdoors and some can't. If you're sitting in front of a glowing screen is your concern.
And it's simply a quantity of time.
Because
I read books on both, on a couple of those different devices, and I like a newspaper. I love reading the Dallas Morning News, but, you know, if I'm not in Dallas, I can read it on the Internet. So it's the screen time. The second half of my book, actually, Chris, as you know, is divided into it's sort of parenting 2.0 for the digital age, and it's divided by age and stage. And so one of the themes, though, that runs about whether you have a 2-year-old, an 8-year-old, or a 15-year-old is limit the amount of screen time. I mean, there's no question that the scientific data shows that too much screen time can have public health consequences.
And the max at any age, and it's less when kids are quite young, but the max is 2 hours per day total screen time. Is that right?
Well, that's recommended. But having said that, obviously there are exceptions to be made. For example, if you want to watch the Dallas Cowboys game, playing the great San Francisco 49ers game, you're going to have to watch for 3 and 3.5 hours. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the ball game. So you're going to be in front. Say you're watching that on TV, you're clearly going to exceed a 2-hour limit. So I think there, that's a good standard to think about, particularly on a daily basis with your kids. But if you're going to, they're going to watch a ball game or two, or you're going to be watching long feature length movies, they're obviously going to be modifications of that. The point is to have a clear sense of limits and to set them. That's really true with video games. So as you were mentioning, Chris, if you have a teenage son or even a preteen son who loves to play games, saying, hey, you can play this for half an hour and that's it, and having a little egg timer or clock there to enforce that limit, that's a great thing to have. And it's good to have certain parameters for your kids to live by, because they need parameters and they need boundaries.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go next on the phone to Mike in Dallas. Hey, Mike.
Hey, good afternoon. In thinking about the earlier comments regarding kids' self-awareness and thinking before they post, a lot of times as parents we're navigating what is native to the digital generation, and the kids nowadays don't really understand the permanency of their digital footprint. And I don't know as many of us parents that really don't understand that either, how we can get more information out to the parents as far as instructing their children. You really have to be careful of what you post digitally, because it really never goes away, even if you delete it.
Mike, you brought up a great question, and we have to take a quick break here. So, Jim, if you'll keep that in your mind and answer right after the break, that would be terrific.
That sounds great, Chris.
My guest this hour is James P. Steyer. He's founder and CEO of Common Sense Media. He's also author of the new book, Talking Back to Facebook, The Common Sense Guide to Raising Kids in the Digital Age. We'll come back to the conversation in a moment. If you'd like to join us, the number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. James P. Steyer is here. He's founder and CEO of Common Sense Media and author of the new book, Talking Back to Facebook, The Common Sense Guide to Raising Kids in the Digital Age. Join us at 1-800-933-5372. And you'll recall, Jim, that's what we heard from Mike right before the break, who wanted some ideas for teaching young people about the permanency of their digital lives.
Well, I think that that it lends itself to a couple of very straightforward solutions that all of us can do, whether it's in Dallas and the broader Texas and Southwest area or all across the country. The first is we can talk with our kids about this and really educate them. I do think this is part of Parenting 101, so I think we all have to be involved in this. And I think it starts at the family level, and it starts with using common sense and resources like commonsense.org and taking advantage of any kind of books and other simple, easy-to-use guides that are out there. But the second thing is schools. So at Common Sense Media, for example, we have a digital literacy, digital citizenship curriculum that's in over 32,000 schools in the United States, many hundreds in the state of Texas. And when I visited Texas a couple of weeks ago, I was down in Austin and met with some of the leading Texas educators. And I think we'll probably end up putting a staff person or two in Texas in the coming year to take that curriculum to every school in Texas, because schools are the locus of education. And whether we like it or not today, media and technology are a part of children's lives, but they're also part of the educational future. So I believe that digital literacy and digital citizenship classes, which include sort of basic rules of the road and tips for teachers students as well as parents should be in every school in the state of Texas, and quite frankly, every school in the country from K through 12. And that will have an enormously beneficial impact on this discussion and the proper ethical, responsible use of digital media and technology.
All right, let's talk about mobile phones. I find it so ironic that we buy these things for our kids because we want to protect them. And ultimately, they get in trouble at a rate of about 100 times for every time that they actually need to call home in an emergency.
Well, I think the idea that, and I think every parent out there should think about that one, because when you ask parents, as I did for this book and as I do for Common Sense all the time, you know, if you ask parents about why they give their kid a mobile phone at like age 9 or 10, they go, safety, safety. I want to keep track of them and I want that emergency call, et cetera. But if you ask kids about why they want a phone, they want it because they want to play games or they want to surf the internet or they want to text their friends. It's not about safety. And I think parents are kidding themselves by and large about that usage. And I would urge parents to think long and hard about the age at which they give their child a phone. Even in a big state like Texas or California, where there's a lot of driving and carpools and soccer games and football games, et cetera, I actually think delaying giving a cell phone to a kid is a very good thing. A, because it forces a conversation between the child and the parent about why you need a phone and what is the purpose of a phone. And B, because it allows you to talk about how kids use them compulsively, some of the costs involved, and also the appropriate use of technology. In our family, I'll tell you, our kids don't get a cell phone until they go to high school. And I think they do just fine with that. So I'm sure many listeners have done it differently in their own families. But I think teaching your kids about cell phone usage and cell phone etiquette, particularly when it comes to texting and distracted driving and distracted interactions with other people, is very important. And cell phones are everywhere, as you know, Chris.
What about text, the limits on text messages? It seems like you can get 150 or you can get unlimited for whatever, $3 more a month. So
Correct. Most
parents choose that for their kids, and kids spend a lot of time messaging their friends.
It's unbelievable, actually. The data on kids, teenagers, and text messages is something around 3,300 texts per kid on average per month. Mm-hmm. So that's over 100 texts a day. And we all know stories of kids who send many, many hundreds of texts per day. So I think you just clearly have to set limits. And that, by the way, is where it may not be a dollar consideration, meaning that pay a couple extra and get unlimited plan. It may be more of you want to send a clear message to your kid that 150 a month is plenty. That would be 5 a day. Maybe they have to learn to set a limit on that and use that device only in certain ways. Because I would much rather encourage my own children to have face-to-face conversations or pick up the phone if necessary, mm-hmm. because then you can hear the emotion in someone's voice. You can understand if they're kidding, if they're angry. You can understand the nuances of a relationship much more than you can from the simple, efficient stroke of a keystroke. And that's why kids use texting. It's fast, it's efficient, and it's impersonal. But I think we as parents need to send them a different message at times.
Are they losing opportunities to develop empathy because so much is done online?
No question, Chris. I think that's a great point. And I tell you, it's interesting. Some of my colleagues at Stanford, and I've been a prof at Stanford now for almost 25 years, are doing really interesting research on empathy and the impact of digital media and technology on empathy and human emotion. And there is no question that an impersonal, at times anonymous relationship via text message or via the internet is very different in terms of empathy than a person-to-person, face-to-face, even over the phone kind of relationship. And so there's no question that this is impacting empathy, but the research is just beginning. It's a fascinating area in terms of human evolution and relationships, communication, et cetera.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Next on the line, we have Sarah in Fort Worth. Hi, Sarah.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Oh, thank you. I did thank you for your show, and thank you, James. I did have a question about how you might word an explanation in a positive way to your children, explaining why their friends and their parents aren't necessarily bad people if they do allow their children to, let's say, sign on Facebook and make an account if they are under the age of 13, and that your family values are a little bit different, but those people aren't maybe bad people?
I take your point completely. The whole different families have different rules, but they're not bad either thing.
I think that's a great question, and I think it's exactly the kind of conversation that it's helpful to have with your kids, and it comes up in the context of media and technology, but in a number of different aspects of parenting. I think it really is important to push the message you just said, that different families are different, that rules are different. We used to always laugh at Common Sense Media that we would have a section of our website entitled, "You're the Only Parent Who," because so many times your kids ask you, "Mom, Dad, you're the only person who doesn't allow that. You're the only person who doesn't do this." And so the truth is families are different and they have different rules. That's why I said the previous point about, you know, age at which you give your kid a cell phone. I can tell you what we do, and Chris, you could reveal or choose not to reveal, you know, your own family policy, but kids are different, families are different, rules are different. The important thing is to have clear rules and stick to them, mm-hmm. and to have a rationale behind it, and then to have that kind of conversation with your child. Because dialogue and communication are the essence of parenting. And it can be hard when you have monosyllabic teenagers, no question. But that doesn't mean you don't have to try it. And it's a very important way sometimes to talk about different relationships they have with other children, with their teachers. You can, you know, some of the tough talks that you have to have with your kids about the birds and the bees or about violence or other uncomfortable subjects oftentimes are made easier if you talk about them in the context of media and entertainment and what's in a movie or what's on a cell phone or on a Facebook page. So in some ways, these platforms can actually promote, if you will, and force important conversations between you and your kids. And that's a good thing. But you should have openness to the fact that not everybody's the same and that no two kids are exactly alike.
We all worry so much these days about bullying, and it seems like we worry much less about a kid coming home with a black eye as about a kid being sort of flamed out by his or her right. friends online.
Well, I think they both matter, Chris. I mean, in truth, I think they both matter because coming home with a black eye or really being bullied on the schoolyard is not a fun experience.
Right.
But in the world of 24/7 digital media, you can indeed see far more stuff around cyberbullying and virtual bullying, which can often be anonymous and very hurtful. We all know the stories of the extreme examples where suicides are involved or very, very tragic endings occur where people are really damaged, sometimes permanently, because of extraordinarily painful things that can happen online. Again, that's part of the self-reveal before you self-reflect and that impulsive nature that online and digital media can lend itself to. But the fact that we've started to have a much more public and national discussion about bullying in Texas and around the country is a very healthy thing, because in a anonymous, oftentimes anonymous and frequently impersonal digital environment, it's so easy to do mean things to people without thinking about the consequences. And quite frankly, if you're the bully, not facing them. So a lot of the educational work we do at Common Sense Media and a lot of the stuff we'll teach in classrooms across Texas, and quite frankly, that's in my book, is about bullying and how to prevent that with really simple steps. But again, part of it is having an honest public discussion about it.
It's interesting because I take the sense from the book and from this discussion that you think parents need to be as vigilant in making sure their child is not bullying as they do in ensuring their child is not being bullied.
I actually do, Chris, and I would ask you as a mom too, you know, don't you as well? I think, I'll tell you why. Because I think that in the world of impulsive decision-making that a cell phone or digital environment can lend itself to, that you sometimes don't consider the consequences. And I think it's important to teach your kids to treat others well. Do unto others as you would want them to do unto you. And so teaching that lesson, use through the medium, if you will, of the new digital technology and your kid's desire for cell phones or a Facebook account or whatever, is actually a very important lesson. I mean, at the end of the day, as a parent, what you really teach your children as they get older are values and judgment. And hopefully by the time they're more and more independent teenagers and certainly young adults, you know, what they have is your values and your judgment and your voice in their ear when they have to make decisions on their own. And I do think that that's an essential element of parenting. And in some ways, this new digital media technology forces us to be more involved in that way, and that's a good thing.
Let's go back to the phones now. This time we have Mick on the line in Weatherford. Hi, Mick.
Hi, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
My question is this, and I'm hearing the cynical teenager in my head from way back when, but it seems to me, for this to be particularly true for teenagers, that as they get older, they'll recognize.
Nick, are you with us? Okay, I think we've lost the signal from Mick, but I believe what he wanted to ask about was reconciling for kids the need to limit their online exposure with a message from schools, which is that you need to do homework and assignments and research online.
It's a great question, actually, Chris, and I'm glad you raised it, because I think it shows you the complexity of this issue, because it's going to be part of our lives going forward. So, and it's why Common Sense has built this digital literacy and digital citizenship curriculum with our colleagues at Harvard and Stanford Ed Schools, and are trying to put it in every school in Texas and around the country. Because on the one hand, there's no question that schools are starting to give out iPads and other tablets, and this may replace the backpack that we all grew up with. And in fact, that digital media and technology are going to be part of some of the most important revolutions in the public education system in the United States in the next decade. Clearly, that will happen. At the same time, you don't want your kids 24/7 glued to that screen, and we want to teach them proper, ethical, reasonable behavior on these platforms. And the two are not incompatible. They both have to happen. But you have to have limits, and schools need to be educated. That's why we created this curriculum at Common Sense, was, quite frankly, the teachers and the principals needed to be educated, because this was new to them. They're not the natives. And so you actually have, that's a great question, because you have to do both. We have to look at the positive uses of technology and media for 21st education and learning. And at the same time, we have to have very clear rules of the road, social norms about what is proper and not proper use of these devices.
The advice in your book, at least the advice that is specifically tailored to specific ages, mm-hmm. ends at 15. After that point, should we assume that we've done our jobs? We give up.
No, but I'll tell you, it was originally 0 to 18, Chris, right? Mm-hmm. And I was sitting there, and what I really came to the conclusion there was is that a parent would read it up to, if they had a 15 or 16-year-old, and would flip to that section of the book if they wanted the tips and the tools for that particular age. And by the time the kid was about 17, they had either taught them the judgment and the values or not. I was thinking of my own children in many cases, because I have two who exceed that limit. Mm-hmm. And what I was really suggesting is by the time kids are 16, 17, 18, they are making more and more of their own independent decisions. And you are still there as their guide and their mom or dad, and you still should be, by the way, well into their 20s and perhaps older. But at that point, kids are really making more of their more independent decisions. And that's why in that second half of the book, the How to Common Sense Parent in a Digital Age, that I ended it at 15 and 16, because I thought, beyond that, most kids are making the great majority of the decisions. While you may be giving them advice and have set overall rules, hopefully, leading up to those ages, they're making the decision now. And this is true on privacy laws, too, by the way, is we believe in opt-in, but I'd say at 16 or 17, the kid should have the choice to opt into certain things as much as their parent should, because they're more and more independent actors at that point.
The new book by James P. Steyer is Talking Back to Facebook, The Common Sense Guide to Raising Kids in the Digital Age. Jim, it's been a fascinating hour. Thank you so much for being with us.
Great to talk to you, Chris. I love talking to a mom of four kids about this topic, and to all the great audience at KERA.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think and find out about upcoming programs at kera.org/think, where you can also download the daily podcast. If you've got comments, questions, or suggestions, email those to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.